straightening up. He grinned at Brianna.
"Congratulations, then," he said. "I think you've found him. That far, at least."
Brianna smiled, her eyes suspiciously bright.
"Yeah," she said softly.
She touched the two sheets of paper with a gentle finger.
"My father."
Claire squeezed her daughter's hand. "If you have your father's hair, it's nice to see you have your mother's brains," she said, smiling. "Let's go and celebrate your discovery with Fiona's dinner."
"Good job," Roger said to Brianna as they followed Claire toward the dining room.
His hand rested lightly on her waist.
"You should be proud of yourself."
"Thanks," she said, with a brief smile. But the pensive expression returned almost at once to the curve of her mouth.
"What is it?"
Roger asked softly, stopping in the hall.
"Is something the matter?"
"No, not really." She turned to face him, a small line visible between the ruddy brows. "It's only... I was just thinking, trying to imagine. What do you think it was like for him? Living in a cave for 7 years? And what happened to him then?" Moved by an impulse, Roger leaned forward and kissed her lightly between the brows.
"I don't know, darling," he said. "But maybe we'll find out."
Part 2. Lallybroch. Chapter 4. The Dun Bonnet. Lallybroch, November 1752. He came down to the house once a month to shave, when one of the boys brought him word it was safe. Always at night, moving soft-footed as a fox through the dark. It seemed necessary somehow, a small gesture toward the concept of civilization. He would slip like a shadow through the kitchen door to be met with Ian's smile or his sister's kiss, and would feel the transformation begin. The basin of hot water, the freshly stropped razor, would be laid ready for him on the table with whatever there was for shaving soap. Now and then it was real soap, if Cousin Jared had sent some from France. More often, just half-rendered tallow, eyes stinging with lye. He could feel the change begin with the first scent of the kitchen, so strong and rich after the wind-thin smells of loch and moor and wood. But it wasn't until he had finished the ritual of shaving that he felt himself altogether human once more. They had learned not to expect him to talk until he had shaved. Words came hard after a month's solitude. Not that he could think of nothing to say. It was more that the words inside formed a logjam in his throat, battling each other to get out in the short time he had. He needed those few minutes of careful grooming to pick and choose what he would say first, and to whom. There was news to hear and to ask about, of English patrols in the district, of politics, of arrests and trials in London and Edinburgh. That he could wait for. Better to talk to Ian about the estate, to Jenny about the children. If it seemed safe, the children would be brought down to say hello to their uncle, to give him sleepy hugs and damp kisses before stumbling back to their beds.
"He'll be getting a man soon," had been his first choice of conversation when he came in September, with a nod towards Jenny's eldest child, his namesake.
The 10-year-old sat at the table with a certain constraint, immensely conscious of the dignity of his temporary position as man of the house.
"Aye, all I need's another of the creatures to worry over," his sister replied tartly.
But she touched her son's shoulder in passing, with a pride that belied her words.
"Have ye word from Ian, then?"
His brother-in-law had been arrested, for the fourth time, 3 weeks before, and taken to Inverness under suspicion of being a Jacobite sympathiser. Jenny shook her head, bringing a covered dish to set before him. The thick, warm smell of partridge pie drifted up from the pricked crust and made his mouth water so heavily he had to swallow before he could speak.
"It's not to fret for," Jenny said, spooning out the pie onto his plate.
Her voice was calm, but the small vertical line between her brows deepened. "I've sent Fergus to show them the deed of Cesson, and Ian's discharge from his regiment. They'll send him home again, so soon as they realise he isn't the Laird of Lallybroch, and there's naught to be gained by devilling him." With a glance at her son, she reached for the ale jug. "Precious chance they have of proving a wee bairn to be a traitor." Her voice was grim, but held a note of satisfaction at the thought of the English court's confusion. The rain-spattered deed of Cesson that proved transfer of the title of Lallybroch from the elder James to the younger had made its appearance in court before, each time foiling the Crown's attempt to seize the estate as the property of a Jacobite traitor. He would feel it begin to slip away when he left, that thin veneer of humanity. More of it gone with each step away from the farmhouse. Sometimes he would keep the illusion of warmth and family all the way to the cave where he hid. Other times it would disappear almost at once, torn away by a chill wind, rank and acrid with the scent of burning. The English had burned three crofts beyond the high field, pulled Hugh Kirby and Jeff Murray from their firesides, and shot them by their own doorsteps, with no question or word of formal accusation. Young Joe Fraser had escaped, warned by his wife, who had seen the English coming, and had lived 3 weeks with Jamie in the cave, until the soldiers were well away from the district, and Ian with them. In October, it had been the older lads he spoke to. Fergus, the French boy he had taken from a Paris brothel, and Rabbi MacNab, the kitchen-maid's son, Fergus's best friend. He had drawn the razor slowly down one cheek and round the angle of his jaw, then wiped the lathered blade against the edge of the basin. From the corner of one eye he caught a faint glimpse of fascinated envy on the face of Rabbi MacNab. Turning slightly, he saw that the three boys, Rabbi, Fergus, and young Jamie, were all watching him intently, mouths slightly open. "Have you no seen a man shave before?" he asked, cocking one brow. Rabbi and Fergus glanced at each other, but left it to young Jamie, as titular owner of the estate, to answer.
"Oh, well, aye, uncle," he said, blushing. "But, I mean..."
He stammered slightly and blushed even harder.
"With my dog gone, and even when he's home, we dinna see him shave himself always. And, well, you've just such a lot of hair on your face, uncle, after a whole month, and it's only we're so glad to see you again, and..."
It dawned on Jamie quite suddenly that to the boys he must seem a most romantic figure, living alone in a cave, emerging at dark to hunt, coming down out of the mist in the night, filthy and wild-haired, beard all in a fierce red sprout. Yes, at their age it likely seemed a glamorous adventure to be an outlaw and live hidden in the heather in a dank, cramped cave. At 15 and 16 and 10, they had no notion of guilt or bitter loneliness, of the weight of a responsibility that couldn't be relieved by action. They might understand fear, of a sort, fear of capture, fear of death, not the fear of solitude, of his own nature, fear of madness, not the constant chronic fear of what his presence might do to them. If they thought about that risk at all, they dismissed it, with a casual assumption of immortality that was the right of boys. "Aye, well," he had said, turning casually back to the looking-glass as young Jamie stuttered to a halt. "Man is born to sorrow and whiskers, one of the plagues of Adam." "Of Adam?" Fergus looked openly puzzled, while the others tried to pretend they had the slightest idea what Jamie was talking about. Fergus, as a Frenchie, wasn't expected to know everything. "Oh, aye." Jamie pulled his upper lip down over his teeth and scraped delicately beneath his nose. "In the beginning, when God made man, Adam's chin was as hairless as Eve's, and their bodies both smooth as a newborn child's," he added, seeing young Jamie's eyes dart toward Rabbi's crotch. Beardless Rabbi still was, but the faint dark down on his upper lip bespoke new sproutings elsewhere.
But when the angel wi' the flaming sword drove them out of Eden, no sooner had they passed the gate of the garden, when the hair began to sprout and itch on Adam's chin, and ever since, man has been cursed with shaving.
He finished his own chin with a final flourish, and bowed theatrically to his audience.
"But what about the other hair?" Rabbi demanded. "You didna shave there."
Young Jamie giggled at the thought, growing red again.
"And a damn good thing, too," his elder namesake observed. "You'd need the devil of a steady hand." "No need of a looking-glass, though," he added, to a chorus of giggles. "What about the ladies?" Fergus said.
His voice broke on the word "ladies" in a bullfrog croak that made the other two laugh harder.
"Certainly les filles have hair there, too. But they do not shave it. Usually not, anyway," he added, clearly thinking of some of the sights of his early life in the brothel.
Jamie heard his sister's footsteps coming down the hall.
"Oh, well, that's no a curse,"
he told his rapt audience, picking up the basin and tossing the contents neatly through the open window.
"God gave that as a consolation to man." "If you've ever the privilege of seeing a woman in her skin, gentlemen," he said, looking over his shoulder toward the door and lowering his voice confidentially, "ye'll observe that the hair there grows in the shape of an arrow, pointing the way, ye ken, so as a poor ignorant man can find his way safe home."
He turned grandly away from the guffawing and sniggers behind him, to be struck suddenly with shame, as he saw his sister coming down the hall with the slow, waddling stride of advanced pregnancy. She was holding the tray with his supper on top of her swelling stomach. How could he have demeaned her so, for a crude jest, and the sake of a moment's camaraderie with the boys?
"Be still," he had snapped at the boys, who stopped giggling abruptly and stared at him in puzzlement.
He hastened forward to take the tray from Jenny and set it on the table. It was a savoury made of goat's meat and bacon, and he saw Fergus's prominent Adam's apple bob in the slender throat at the smell of it. He knew they saved the best of the food for him. It didn't take much looking at the pinched faces across the table. When he came, he brought what meat he could, snared rabbits or grouse, sometimes a nest of plover's eggs, but it was never enough, for a house where hospitality must stretch to cover the needs of not only family and servants, but the families of the murdered Kirby and Murray. At least until spring, the widows and children of his tenants must bide here, and he must do his best to feed them.
"Sit down by me," he said to Jenny,
taking her arm and gently guiding her to a seat on the bench beside him. She looked surprised. It was her habit to wait on him when he came, but sat down gladly enough. It was late, and she was tired. He could see the dark smudges beneath her eyes. With great firmness, he cut a large slab of the savoury and set the plate before her.
"But that's all for you," Jenny protested. "I've eaten."
"Not enough," he said. "You need more. For the babe," he added with inspiration.
If she wouldn't eat for herself, she would for the child. She hesitated a moment longer, but then smiled at him, picked up her spoon, and began to eat. Now it was November, and the chill struck through the thin shirt and breeches he wore. He hardly noticed, intent on his tracking. It was cloudy, but with a thin-layered mackerel sky through which the full moon shed plenty of light. Thank God it wasn't raining. Impossible to hear through the pattering of raindrops, and the pungent scent of wet plants masked the smell of animals. His nose had grown almost painfully acute through the long months of living outdoors. The smells of the house sometimes nearly knocked him down when he stepped inside. He wasn't quite close enough to smell the musky scent of the stag, but he heard the telltale rustle of its brief start when it scented him. Now it would be frozen, one of the shadows that rippled across the hillside around him under the racing clouds. He turned as slowly as he possibly could toward the spot where his ears had told him the stag stood. His bow was in his hand, an arrow ready to the string. He would have one shot, maybe, when the stag bolted. Yes, there. His heart sprang into his throat as he saw the antlers pricking sharp and black above the surrounding gorse. He steadied himself, took a deep breath, and then the one step forward. The crash of a deer's flight was always startlingly loud to frighten back a stalker. This stalker was prepared, though. He neither startled nor pursued, but stood his ground, sighting along the shaft of the arrow, following with his eye the track of the springing deer, judging the moment, holding fire, and then the bowstring slapped his wrist with stinging force. It was a clean shot, just behind the shoulder, and a good thing, too. He doubted he had the strength to run down a full-grown stag. It had fallen in a clear spot behind a clump of gorse. Legs stuck out, stiff as sticks, in the oddly helpless way of dying ungulates. The hunter's moon lit its glazing eye, so the soft dark stare was hidden, the mystery of its dying shielded by blank silver. He pulled the dirk from his belt and knelt by the deer, hastily saying the words of the Gralloch prayer. Old John Murray, Ian's father, had taught him. His own father's mouth had twisted slightly, hearing it, from which he gathered that this prayer was perhaps not addressed to the same God they spoke to in church on Sunday. But his father had said nothing, and he had mumbled the words himself, scarcely noticing what he said in the nervous excitement of feeling old John's hand steady on his own, for the first time pressing down the knife blade into hairy hide and steaming flesh. Now, with the sureness of practice, he thrust up the sticky muzzle in one hand and with the other slit the deer's throat. The blood spurted hot over knife and hand, pumping two or three times, the jet dying away to a steady stream as the carcass drained, the great vessels of the throat cut through. Had he paused to think, he might not have done it, but hunger and dizziness and the cold, fresh intoxication of the night had taken him far past the point of thinking. He cupped his hands beneath the running stream and brought them steaming to his mouth. The moon shone black on his cupped, spilling hands, and it was as though he absorbed the deer's substance rather than drank it. The taste of the blood was salt and silver, and the heat of it was his own. There was no startlement of hot or cold as he swallowed, only the taste of it rich in his mouth, and the head-swimming, hot metal smell, and the sudden clench and rumble of his belly at the nearness of food. He closed his eyes and breathed, and the cold, damp air came back between the hot reek of the carcass and his senses. He swallowed once, then wiped the back of his hand across his face, cleaned his hands on the grass, and set about the business at hand. There was the sudden effort of moving the limp, heavy carcass, and then the Gralloch, the long stroke of mingled strength and delicacy that slit the hide between the legs, but didn't penetrate the sack that held the entrails. He forced his hands into the carcass, a hot, wet intimacy, and again there was an effortful tug that brought out the sack, slick and moon shining in his hands. A slash above and another below, and the mass slid free, the transformation of black magic that changed a deer to meat. It was a small stag, although it had points to its antlers. With luck, he could carry it alone, rather than leave it to the mercy of foxes and badgers until he could bring help to move it. He ducked a shoulder under one leg and slowly rose, grunting with effort as he shifted the burden to a solid resting place across his back. The moon cast his shadow on a rock, humped and fantastic as he made his slow, ungainly way down the hill. The deer's antlers bobbed above his shoulder, giving him in shadowed profile the semblance of a horned man. He shivered slightly at the thought, remembering tales of witches' sabbats, where the horned one came to drink the sacrifice of goats' or roosters' blood. He felt a little queasy, and more than a little light-headed. More and more he felt the disorientation, the fragmenting of himself between day and night. By day, he was a creature of the mind alone, as he escaped his damp immobility by a stubborn, disciplined retreat into the avenues of thought and meditation, seeking refuge in the pages of books. But with the rising of the moon, all sense fled, succumbing at once to sensation as he emerged into the fresh air like a beast from its lair, to run the dark hills beneath the stars and hunt, driven by hunger, drunk with blood and moonlight. He stared at the ground as he walked, night sight keen enough to keep his footing despite the heavy burden. The deer was limp and cooling, its stiff, soft hair scratching against the back of his neck, and his own sweat cooling in the breeze, as though he shared his prey's fate. It was only as the lights of Lallybroch Manor came into view that he felt at last the mantle of humanity fall upon him, and mind and body joined as one again as he prepared himself to greet his family. Chapter 5. To Us a Child is Given. 3 weeks later, there was still no word of Ian's return. No word of any kind, in fact. Fergus hadn't come to the cave in several days, leaving Jamie in a fret of worry over how things might be at the house. If nothing else, the deer he had shot would have gone long since with all the extra mouths to feed, and there will be precious little from the kale yard at this time of year. He was sufficiently worried to risk an early visit, checking his snares and coming down from the hills just before sunset. Just in case, he was careful to pull on the woolen bonnet, knitted of rough dun yarn that would hide his hair from any telltale fingering of late sunbeams. His size alone might provoke suspicion, but not certainty, and he had full confidence in the strength of his legs to carry him out of harm's way should he have the ill luck to meet with an English patrol. Hares in the heather were little match for Jamie Fraser, given warning. The house was strangely quiet as he approached. There was none of the usual racket made by children. Jenny's five and the six bairns belonging to the tenants, to say nothing of Fergus and Rabbi McNab, who were a long way from being too old to chase each other round the stables, screeching like fiends. The house felt strangely empty round him as he paused just inside the kitchen door. He was standing in the back hall, the pantry to one side, the scullery to the other, and the main kitchen just beyond. He stood stock still, reaching out with all his senses, listening as he inhaled the overpowering smells of the house. No, there was someone here. The faint sound of a scrape, followed by a soft, regular clinking, came from behind the cloth-padded door that kept the heat of the kitchen from seeping out into the chilly back pantry. It was a reassuringly domestic sound, so he pushed open the door cautiously, but without undue fear. His sister Jenny, alone and vastly pregnant, was standing at the table, stirring something in a yellow bowl.
"What are you doing in here? Where's Mrs. Cooker?"
His sister dropped the spoon with a startled shriek.
"Jamie!"
Pale-faced, she pressed a hand to her breast and closed her eyes.
"Christ! You scared the bells out of me!"
She opened her eyes, dark blue like his own, and fixed him with a penetrating stare.
"And what in the name of the Holy Mother are you doing here now? I wasn't expecting you for a week at least."
"Fergus hasn't come up the hill lately. I got worried," he said simply.
"You're a sweet man, Jamie."
The colour was coming back into her face. She smiled at her brother and came close to hug him. It was an awkward business, with the impending baby in the way, but pleasant nonetheless. He rested his cheek for a moment on the sleek darkness of her head, breathing in her complex aroma of candle wax and cinnamon, tallow soap and wool. There was an unusual element to her scent this evening. He thought she was beginning to smell of milk.
"Where is everyone?" he asked, releasing her reluctantly.
"Well,
"Mrs. Cooker's dead," she answered, the faint crease between her brows deepening.
"Aye,"
he said softly, and crossed himself.
"I'm sorry for it."
Mrs. Cooker had been first housemaid and then housekeeper for the family since the marriage of his own parents 40-odd years before.
"When?"
"Yesterday forenoon. 'Twasn't unexpected, poor soul, and it was peaceful. She died in her own bed like she wanted, and Father McMurtry praying over her."
Jamie glanced reflexively toward the door that led to the servants' rooms off the kitchen.
"Is she still here?"
His sister shook her head.
"No. I told her son they should have the wake here at the house, but the Cookers thought,
everything being like it is..."
Her small moo encompassed Ian's absence, lurking redcoats, refugee tenants, the dearth of food, and his own inconvenient presence in the cave. "They thought better to have it at Broch Morda, at her sister's place.
So that's where everyone's gone. I told them I didn't feel well enough to go," she added,
then smiled, raising an impish brow.
"But it was really that I wanted a few hours' peace and quiet, with a lot of them gone." "And here I've come, breaking in on your peace,"
Jamie said ruefully.
"Shall I go?"
"No, Clotilde," his sister said affably. "Sit ye down, and I'll get on with the supper."
"What's to eat, then?"
he asked, sniffing hopefully.
"Depends on what you've brought,"
his sister replied. She moved heavily about the kitchen, taking things from cupboard and hutch, pausing to stir the large kettle hung over the fire, from which a thin steam was rising.
"If you've brought meat, we'll have it. If not, it's brose and hoch."
He made a face at this. The thought of boiled barley and shin beef, the last remnants of the salted beef carcass they'd bought 2 months before, was unappealing.
"Just as well I had luck, then," he said.
He upended his game bag and let the three rabbits fall onto the table in a limp tumble of grey fur and crumpled ears.
"And blackthorn berries," he added, tipping out the contents of the dun bonnet, now stained inside with the rich red juice.
Jenny's eyes brightened at the sight.
"Hare pie," she declared.
"There's no currants, but the berries will do even better, and there's enough butter, thank God."
Catching a tiny blink of movement among the grey fur, she slapped her hand down on the table, neatly obliterating the minuscule intruder.
"Take them out and skin them, Jamie, or the kitchen will be hopping with fleas."
This ends Disc 2. Voyager, Disc 3.
Returning with the skinned carcasses, he found the pie crust well advanced, and Jenny with smears of flour on her dress.
"Cut them into collops and break the bones for me, will you, Jamie?" she said,
frowning at Mrs. McClintock's receipts for cookery and pastry work laid open on the table beside the pie pan.
"Surely you can make hare pie without looking in the wee book," he said,
obligingly taking the big bone-crushing wooden mallet from the top of the hutch where it was kept. He grimaced as he took it into his hand, feeling the weight of it. It was very like the one that had broken his right hand several years before in an English prison, and he had a sudden, vivid memory of the shattered bones in a hare pie, splintered and cracked, leaking salty blood and the marrow sweetness into the meat.
"Aye, I can,"
his sister answered abstractedly, thumbing through the pages.
"It's only that when you haven't got half the things you need to make a dish, sometimes there's something else you'll come across in here that you can use instead."
She frowned at the page before her.
"Ordinarily, I'd use claret in the sauce, but we've none in the house, save one of Jared's casks in the priest hole, and I didn't want to broach that yet. We might need it."
He didn't need telling what she might use it for. A cask of claret might grease the skids for Ian's release, or at least pay for news of his welfare. He stole a sideways glance at the great round of Jenny's belly. It wasn't for a man to say,
but to his not inexperienced eyes, she looked damn near her time. Absently, he reached over the kettle and swished the blade of his dirk to and fro in the scalding liquid, then pulled it out and wiped it clean.
"Why ever did you do that, Jimmy?"
He turned to find Jenny staring at him. The black curls were coming undone from their ribbon, and it gave him a pang to see the glimmer of a single white hair among the ebony.
"Oh," he said, too obviously offhand as he picked up one carcass. "Claire, she told me you ought to wash off a blade in boiling water before you touched food with it."
He felt, rather than saw, Jenny's eyebrows rise. She had asked him about Claire only once, when he had come home from Culloden, half-conscious and mostly dead with fever.
"She is gone," he had said,
and turned his face away.
"Dinna speak her name to me again."
Loyal as always, Jenny had not, and neither had he. He couldn't have said what made him say it today, unless perhaps it was the dreams. He had them often, in varying forms, and it always unsettled him the day after, as though for a moment Claire had really been near enough to touch, and then had drawn away again. He could swear that sometimes he woke with the smell of her on him, musky and rich, pricked with the sharp fresh scents of leaves and green herbs. He had spilled his seed in his sleep more than once while dreaming, an occurrence that left him faintly ashamed and uneasy in mind. To distract both of them, he nodded at Jenny's stomach.
"How close is it?" he asked, frowning at her swollen midsection. "You look like a puffball mushroom. One touch and poof!"
He flicked his fingers wide in illustration.
"Oh, aye? Well, and I could wish it was as easy as poof!"
She arched her back, rubbing at the small of it and making her belly protrude in an alarming fashion. He pressed back against the wall to give it room.
"As for when? Any time, I expect. No telling, for sure."
She picked up the cup and measured out the flour. "Precious little left in the bag," he noted with some grimness.
"Send up to the Keev when it starts," he said suddenly.
"I'll come down, redcoats or no."
Jenny stopped stirring and stared at him.
"You? Why?"
"Well, Ian's not here," he pointed out,
picking up one skinned carcass. With the expertise of long practice, he neatly disjointed a thigh and cut it free from the backbone. Three quick smacks with the boning mallet, and the pale flesh lay flattened and ready for the pie.
"And a great lot of help he'd be if he was," Jenny said. "He took care of his part of the business 9 months ago."
She wrinkled her nose at her brother and reached for the plate of butter.
"Mm-hmm."
He sat down to continue his work, which brought her belly close to his eye level. The contents, awake and active, was shifting to and fro in a restless manner, making her apron twitch and bulge as she stirred. He couldn't resist reaching out to put a light hand against the monstrous curve to feel the surprising strong thrusts and kicks of the inhabitant, impatient of its cramped confinement.
"Send Fergus for me when it's time," he said again.
She looked down at him in exasperation and batted his hand away with a spoon.
"Have I not just been telling you? I dinna need you.
For God's sake, man, have I not enough to worry me with a house full of people and scarce enough to feed them? Ian in jail in Inverness, and redcoats crawling in at the windows every time I look round. Should I have to worry that ye'll be taken up as well?"
"Ye needn't be worried for me. I'll take care."
He didn't look at her, but focused his attention on the forejoint he was slicing through.
"Well then, have a care and stay put on the hill."
She looked down her long, straight nose, peering at him over the rim of the bowl.
"I've had 6 bairns already, aye?
You dinna think I can manage by now?"
"No arguing with you, is there?" he demanded.
"No," she said promptly. "So you'll stay?"
"I'll come."
Jenny narrowed her eyes and gave him a long, level look. "You may be the most stubborn gomeral between here and Aberdeen, no?" A smile spread across her brother's face as he looked up at her.
"Maybe so," he said.
He reached across and patted her heaving belly.
"And maybe no. But I'm coming. Send Fergus when it's time."
It was near dawn 3 days later that Fergus came panting up the slope to the cave, missing the trail in the dark, and making such a crashing through the gorse bushes that Jamie heard him coming long before he reached the opening. "Milor," he began breathlessly, as he emerged by the head of the trail. But Jamie was already past the boy, pulling his cloak around his shoulders as he hurried down toward the house.
"But, milor!"
Fergus's voice came behind him, panting and frightened.
"Milor, the soldiers!"
"Soldiers?"
He stopped suddenly and turned, waiting impatiently for the French lad to make his way down the slope.
"What soldiers?"
he demanded, as Fergus slithered the last few feet.
"English dragoons, milor. Milady sent me to tell you, on no account are you to leave the cave. One of the men saw the soldiers yesterday, camped near Dunmaglass."
"Damn."
"Yes, milor."
Fergus sat down on a rock and fanned himself, narrow chest heaving as he caught his breath. Jamie hesitated, irresolute. Every instinct fought against going back into the cave. His blood was heated by the surge of excitement caused by Fergus's appearance, and he rebelled at the thought of meekly crawling back into hiding like a grub seeking refuge beneath its rock.
"Mm-hmm," he said.
He glanced down at Fergus. The changing light was beginning to outline the boy's slender form against the blackness of the gorse, but his face was still a pale smudge, marked with a pair of darker smudges that were his eyes. A certain suspicion was stirring in Jamie. Why had his sister sent Fergus at this odd hour? If it had been necessary urgently to warn him about the dragoons, it would have been safer to send the boy up during the night. If the need wasn't urgent, why not wait until the next night? The answer to that was obvious, because Jenny thought she might not be able to send him word the next night.
"How is it with my sister?" he asked Fergus.
"Oh, well, milor. Quite well."
The hearty tone of this assurance confirmed all Jamie's suspicions.
"She's having the child, no?" he demanded.
"No, milor. Certainly not."
Jamie reached down and clamped a hand on Fergus's shoulder. The bones felt small and fragile beneath his fingers, reminding him uncomfortably of the rabbits he had broken for Jenny. Nonetheless, he forced his grip to tighten. Fergus squirmed, trying to ease away.
"Tell me the truth, man," Jamie said.
"No, milor, truly."
The grip tightened inexorably.
"Did she tell you not to tell me?"
Jenny's prohibition must have been a literal one, for Fergus answered this question with evident relief.
"Yes, milor."
"Ah."
He relaxed his grip, and Fergus sprang to his feet, now talking volubly as he rubbed his scrawny shoulder.
"She said I must not tell you anything except about the soldiers, milor. For if I did, she would cut off my cods and boil them like turnips and sausage."
Jamie couldn't repress a smile at this threat.
"Short of food we may be," he assured his protégé, "but not that short."
He glanced at the horizon, where a thin line of pink showed pure and vivid behind the black pine's silhouette.
"Come along, then. It'll be full light in half an hour."
There was no hint of silent emptiness about the house this dawn. Anyone with half an eye could see that things were not as usual at Lallybroch. The wash kettle sat on its plinth in the yard, with the fire gone out under it, full of cold water and sodden clothes. Moaning cries from the barn, like someone being strangled, indicated that the sole remaining cow urgently required milking.
and irritable blatting from the goat shed let him know that the female inhabitants would like some similar attention as well. As he came into the yard, three chickens ran past in a feathery squawk, with Yehu, the rat terrier, in close pursuit. With a quick dart, he leapt forward and booted the dog, catching it just under the ribs. It flew into the air with a look of intense surprise on its face, then, landing with a yip, picked itself up and made off. He found the children, the older boys, Mary McNab, and the other housemaid, Suki, all crammed into the parlour under the watchful eye of Mrs. Kirby, a stern and rock-ribbed widow who was reading to them from the Bible. "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression," read Mrs. Kirby. There was a loud rolling scream from upstairs that seemed to go on and on. Mrs. Kirby paused for a moment to allow everyone to appreciate it before resuming the reading. Her eyes, pale grey and wet as raw oysters, flickered toward the ceiling, then rested with satisfaction on the row of strained faces before her. "Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if she continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety," she read. Kitty burst into hysterical sobbing and buried her head in her sister's shoulder. Maggie Ellen was growing bright red beneath her freckles, while her elder brother had gone dead white at the scream. "Mrs. Kirby," said Jamie, "be still, if you please." The words were civil enough, but the look in his eyes must have been the one that Yehu saw just before his boot-assisted flight, for Mrs. Kirby gasped and dropped the Bible, which landed on the floor with a papery thump. Jamie bent and picked it up, then showed Mrs. Kirby his teeth. The expression evidently was not successful as a smile, but had some effect, nevertheless. Mrs. Kirby went quite pale and put a hand to her ample bosom. "Perhaps she'd go to the kitchen and make yourself useful," he said, with a jerk of his head that sent Suki the kitchen-maid scuttling out like a wind-blown leaf. With considerable more dignity, but no hesitation, Mrs. Kirby rose and followed her. Heartened by this small victory, Jamie disposed of the parlour's other occupants in short order, sending the widow Murray and her daughters out to deal with the wash kettle, the smaller children out to catch chickens under the supervision of Mary McNab. The older lads departed, with obvious relief, to tend the stock. The room, empty at last, he stood for a moment, hesitating as to what to do next. He felt obscurely that he should stay in the house, on guard, though he was acutely aware that he could, as Jenny had said, do nothing to help, whatever happened. There was an unfamiliar mule hobbled in the dooryard. Presumably the midwife was upstairs with Jenny. Unable to sit, he prowled restlessly around the parlour, the Bible in his hand, touching things. Jenny's bookshelf battered and scarred from the last incursion of redcoats 3 months ago. The big silver epergne. That was slightly dented, but had been too heavy to fit in a soldier's knapsack, and so had escaped the pilfering of smaller objects. Not that the English had got so much. The few truly valuable items, along with the tiny store of gold they had left, were safely tucked away in the priest hole with Jared's wine. Hearing a prolonged moan from above, he glanced down involuntarily at the Bible in his hand. Not really wanting to, still he let the book fall open, showing the page at the front where the marriages, births, and deaths of the family were recorded. The entries began with his parents' marriage, Brian Fraser and Ellen Mackenzie. The names and the date were written in his mother's fine round hand, with underneath a brief notation in his father's firmer, blacker scrawl. "Married for love," it said. A pointed observation in view of the next entry, which showed Willie's birth, which had occurred scarcely 2 months past the date of the marriage. Jamie smiled, as always, at the sight of the words, and glanced up at the painting of himself, aged 2,
standing with Willie and Bran, the huge deerhound. All that was left of Willie, who had died of the smallpox at 11. The painting had a slash through the canvas. The work of a bayonet, he supposed, taking out its owner's frustration.
"And if you hadn't a died," he said softly to the picture, "then what?"
Then what indeed? Closing the book, his eye caught the last entry. Caitlin Masry Murray, born December 3rd, 1749. Died December 3rd, 1749.
Aye, if.
If the redcoats hadn't come on December the 2nd, would Jenny have borne the child too early? If they had had enough food, so that she, like the rest of them, was no more than skin and bones and the bulge of her belly, would that have helped?
"No telling, is there?"
he said to the painting. Willie's painted hand rested on his shoulder. He had always felt safe with Willie standing behind him. Another scream came from upstairs, and a spasm of fear clenched his hands on the book.
"Pray for us, brother," he whispered,
and crossing himself, laid down the Bible and went out to the barn to help with the stock. There was little to do here. Rabbi and Fergus between them were more than able to take care of the few animals that remained, and young Jamie, at 10, was big enough to be a substantial help. Looking about for something to do, Jamie gathered up an armful of scattered hay and took it down the slope to the midwife's mule. When the hay was gone, the cow would have to be slaughtered. Unlike the goats, it couldn't get enough forage on the winter hills to sustain it, even with the picked grass and weeds the small children brought in. With luck, the salted carcass would last them through till spring. As he came back into the barn, Fergus looked up from his manure fork.
"This is a proper midwife of good repute?" Fergus demanded.
He thrust out a long chin aggressively.
"Madame should not be entrusted to the care of a peasant, surely?"
"How should I know?"
Jamie said testily. "D'you think I had anything to do with engaging midwives?"
Mrs. Martin, the old midwife who had delivered all previous Murray children, had died, like so many others, during the famine in the year following Culloden. Mrs. Innes, the new midwife, was much younger. He hoped she had sufficient experience to know what she was doing. Rabbi seemed inclined to join the argument as well. He scowled blackly at Fergus.
"Aye, and what do you mean, peasant? You're a peasant too, have you not noticed?"
Fergus stared down his nose at Rabbi with some dignity, despite the fact that he was forced to tilt his head backwards in order to do so, he being several inches shorter than his friend.
"Whether I am a peasant or not is of no consequence," he said loftily. "I am not a midwife, am I?" "No, you're a fiddle, my fike."
Rabbi gave his friend a rough push, and with a sudden whoop of surprise, Fergus fell backward to land heavily on the stable floor. In a flash he was up. He lunged at Rabbi, who sat laughing on the edge of the manger. But Jamie's hand snatched him by the collar and pulled him back.
"None of that," said his employer. "I will not have you spoiling what little he's left."
He set Fergus back on his feet, and to distract him asked,
"And what do you ken of midwives anyway?"
"A great deal, my lord."
Fergus dusted himself off with elegant gestures.
"Many of the ladies at Madame Elise's were brought to bed while I was there."
"I dare say they were,"
Jamie interjected dryly.
"Or is it childbed, you mean?"
"Childbed, certainly. Why, I was born there myself."
The French boy puffed his narrow chest importantly.
"Indeed."
Jamie's mouth quirked slightly.
"Well, and I trust you made careful observations at the time, so as to see how such matters should be arranged."
Fergus ignored this piece of sarcasm.
"Well, of course," he said matter-of-factly. "The midwife will naturally have put a knife beneath the bed to cut the pain." "I'm none so sure she did that," Rabbi muttered.
At least it doesn't sound much like it.
Most of the screaming was inaudible from the barn, but not all of it.
And an egg should be blessed with holy water and put at the foot of the bed, so that the woman shall bring forth the child easily,
Fergus continued, oblivious.
He frowned.
I gave the woman an egg myself, but she did not appear to know what to do with it. And I'd been keeping it especially for the last month, too, he added plaintively, since the hens scarcely lay any more. I wanted to be sure of having one when it was needed.
Now, following the birth, he went on, losing his doubts in the enthusiasm of his lecture, the midwife must brew a tea of the placenta and give it to the woman to drink so that her milk will flow strongly.
Rabbi made a faint retching sound.
Of the afterbirth, you mean? He said disbelievingly. God!
Jamie felt a bit queasy at this exhibition of modern medical knowledge himself.
Well, he said to Rabbi, striving for casualness. They eat frogs, you know, and snails. I suppose maybe afterbirth isn't so strange, considering.
Privately, he wondered whether it might not be long before they were all eating frogs and snails, but thought that a speculation better kept to himself.
Rabbi made mock puking noises.
Christ, who'd be a Frenchie?
Fergus, standing close to Rabbi, whirled and shot out a lightning fist. Fergus was small and slender for his age, but strong for all that, and with a deadly aim for a man's weak points. Knowledge acquired as a juvenile pickpocket on the streets of Paris. The blow caught Rabbi squarely in the wind, and he doubled over with a sound like a stepped-on pig's bladder.
"Speak with respect of your betters, if you please,"
Fergus said haughtily. Rabbi's face turned several shades of red, and his mouth opened and closed like a fish's as he struggled to get his breath back. His eyes bulged with a look of intense surprise, and he looked so ridiculous that it was a struggle for Jamie not to laugh, despite his worry over Jenny and his irritation at the boys' squabbling.
"Will ye wee doiters no keep your paws off?"
he began, when he was interrupted by a cry from young Jamie, who had until now been silent, fascinated by the conversation.
"What?"
Jamie whirled, hand going automatically to the pistol he carried whenever he left the cave. But there was not, as he had half expected, an English patrol in the stable-yard.
"What the hell is it?" he demanded.
Then, following young Jamie's pointing finger, he saw them. Three small black specks drifting across the brown crumple of dead vines in the potato field.
"Ravens,"
he said softly, and felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. For those birds of war and slaughter to come to a house during a birth was the worst sort of ill luck. One of the filthy beasts was actually settling on the roof tree as he watched. With no conscious thought, he took the pistol from his belt and braced the muzzle across his forearm, sighting carefully. It was a long shot from the door of the stable to the roof tree, and sighted upward too. Still, the pistol jerked in his hand, and the raven exploded in a cloud of black feathers. Its two companions shot into the air as though blown there by the explosion, and flapped madly away, their hoarse cries fading quickly on the winter air.
"Mon Dieu!" Fergus exclaimed. "C'est bien ça?" "Aye, bonne shooting, sir."
Rabbi, still red-faced and a little breathless, had recovered himself in time to see the shot. Now he nodded toward the house, pointing with his chin.
"Look, sir, is that the midwife?"
It was. Mrs. Innes poked her head out of the second-story window, fair hair flying loose as she leaned out to peer into the yard below. Perhaps she had been drawn by the sound of the shot, fearing some trouble. Jamie stepped into the stable-yard and waved at the window to reassure her.
"That's all right," he shouted. "Only an accident."
He didn't mean to mention the ravens, lest the midwife tell Jenny.
"Come up," she shouted, ignoring this. "The bairn's born, and your sister wants you."
Jenny opened one eye, blue and slightly slanted like his own.
"So you came, aye?"
"I thought someone should be here, if only to pray for you," he said gruffly.
She closed the eye, and a small smile curved her lips. She looked, he thought, very like a painting he had seen in France, an old one by some Italian fellow, but a good picture, nonetheless.
"You're a silly fool, and I'm glad of it," she said softly.
She opened her eyes and glanced down at the swaddled bundle she held in the crook of her arm.
"Do you want to see him?"
"Oh, a him, is it?"
With hands experienced by years of unclehood, he lifted the tiny package and cuddled it against himself, pushing back the flap of blanket that shaded its face. Its eyes were closed tight shut, the lashes not visible in the deep crease of the eyelids. The eyelids themselves lay at a sharp angle above the flushed, smooth rounds of the cheeks, giving promise that it might, in this one recognisable feature at least, resemble its mother. The head was oddly lumpy, with a lopsided appearance that made Jamie think uncomfortably of a kicked-in melon, but the small fat mouth was relaxed and peaceful, the moist pink underlip quivering faintly with the snore attendant on the exhaustion of being born.
"Hard work, was it?" he said, speaking to the child,
but it was the mother who answered him.
"Aye, it was," Jenny said. "There's whiskey in the armoire. Will you fetch me a glass?"
Her voice was hoarse, and she had to clear her throat before finishing the request.
"Whiskey? Should you not be having ale with eggs beaten up in it?"
he asked, repressing with some difficulty a mental vision of Fergus's suggestion of appropriate sustenance for newly delivered mothers.
"Whiskey,"
his sister said definitely.
"When you were lying downstairs, crippled and your leg killing you, did I give you ale wi' eggs beaten up in it?"
"You fed me stuff a damn sight worse than that," her brother said with a grin. "But you're right, you gave me whiskey too."
He laid the sleeping child carefully on the coverlet and turned to get the whiskey.
"Has he a name yet?"
he asked, nodding toward the baby as he poured out a generous cup of the amber liquid.
"I'll call him Ian, for his da."
Jenny's hand rested gently for a moment on the rounded skull, lightly furred with a gold-brown fuzz. A pulse beat visibly in the soft spot on top. It seemed hideously fragile to Jamie, but the midwife had assured him the babe was a fine, lusty lad, and he supposed he must take her word for it. Moved by an obscure impulse to protect that nakedly exposed soft spot, he picked up the baby once more, pulling the blanket up over its head.
"Mary McNab told me about you and Mrs. Kirby," Jenny remarked, sipping. "Pity I didn't see it. She said the wretched old bism nearly swallowed her tongue when you spoke to her."
Jamie smiled in return, gently patting the baby's back as it lay against his shoulder. Dead asleep, the little body lay inert as a boneless ham, a soft, comforting weight.
"Too bad she didn't. How can you stand the woman living in the same house with her? I'd strangle her, were I here every day."
His sister snorted and closed her eyes, tilting her head back to let the whiskey slide down her throat.
"Ah, folks fash ye as much as you let them. I dinna let her much. Still," she added, opening her eyes, "I canna say as I'll be sorry to be rid of her. I have it in my mind to palm her off on old Kettrick down at Brochmorda. His wife and his daughter both died last year, and he'll be wanting someone to do for him."
"Aye, but if I were Samuel Kettrick, I'd take the widow Murray," Jamie observed. "Not the widow Kirby."
"Peggy Murray's already provided for," his sister assured him. "She'll wed Duncan Gibbons in the spring."
"That's fast work for Duncan," he said, a little surprised. Then a thought occurred to him, and he grinned at her.
Do either of them know it yet?
No, she said, grinning back.
Then the smile faded into a speculative look.
Unless you were thinking of Peggy yourself, that is.
Me? Jamie was as startled as if she had suddenly suggested he might wish to jump out of the second-story window.